This week on the show, citizen journalism, more stuff for free, and how Cast can't teach anyone how to iron. Right here on This Week in Media, number 93. We are back for This Week in Media. You just heard that at the beginning of the show, but I thought I'd remind you just in case you were wondering. And we're all in the studio here. We have John Foster. Hey, John.
I don't have all of my voice, though.
John came with half his voice. We told him to bring the whole voice, and he only brought half of it.
I had to send the voice to the shop.
Damn it.
He wants to sound husky.
Also here, John Flowers.
I have the other half of the voice.
He's got all of the voice. He's got a voice and a half. He's learned how to use that mic. I'm so proud of you. You're doing such a good job.
The mic's not going to help my voice no matter what.
Also here, Daisy Whitney. Hey.
Hello, I have the voice on caffeine today, like you.
I had a little too much. I got new tea, and I got kind of excited about it.
What kind?
Bewley's. Bewley's. It's like
green,
a gold
black
clipper. It's a black tea. It's got lots of caffeine, and if Trish Meyer is listening, it's because she recommended it, and I probably shouldn't have drank two whole pots this morning.
That's about what I had too of my green tea.
Anyway, so I'm feeling a little frisky. So anyway, we've got all kinds of good stuff. Now, coming up last week, I think this was a big deal. Oh, before we get to this, to make this like an ADD special, did you guys see Indiana?
Yes.
Yes.
I did the unique thing and I tweeted about it as I was watching the movie.
See, now they're not
scene
now
by
you're going
scene
crazy.
During the movie?
Yeah, during the movie. While I was doing it during, yeah,
right.
And it was the thing to do.
And people were responding with, are you tweeting from the movie? Yeah,
and the people behind you were like,
exactly.
Who is that?
Why is that?
Yeah, what's that white going? I have Twitter during movies before, and then it's really embarrassing if someone's behind you because you're...
That's
really,
my husband did that once when...
Once.
Yeah, exactly. I made it very clear. You were to put your BlackBerry away during the movies. If you don't like it, you're welcome to leave and go wait in the lobby, okay? But that is not acceptable. He spent the entire movie of The Upside of Anger playing Brick Breaker or something on his BlackBerry.
I can see that. The Upside of Anger was kind of...
All I know was I wasn't giving away any secrets, but I was playing Mystery Science Theater along while watching it. It begged to be made fun of.
What did you think? I take it you didn't like it.
I have, you know, the problem with it is that they've had 19 years to come up with this script, and this is what they gave us. And you know, I'm not the writer of that. But I do know that it's going to make $1 billion. And so, once again, why isn't it the best thing ever?
Well, I think best thing ever is a very amorphous, hard to reach goal.
I thought that, I mean, Raiders of the Lost Ark is in my top five of all time favorite movies. And it's really hard for anything to compare to it. And this definitely doesn't compare to it. But I see it as a little bit closer to Last Crusade than Temple of Doom. And it was just so great to see
Indiana
Jones back on
screen. I actually like Temple of Doom.
Did you really?
Yeah, everyone makes so much fun of Temple of Doom. And I was like, I kind of like that one better than Last Crusade.
Temple of Dom.
I liked the Temple of Doom. I liked Short Round.
I thought it had enough good parts in this last movie. But you know what the worst part is? Okay, and this is the chick point.
You cheat, Dr. John. You cheat.
Sorry. Okay, so I have to share the chick point of view. Okay, George Lucas has the heaviest hand when it comes to writing relationships.
Yeah.
I don't want to give away the end of the movie for people who haven't seen it, but it's like, does he have to be so... Was that just like Star Wars, like Phantom Menace or whatever between Padme and Anakin when they just have their cheesy relationship? Like,
exactly.
He has no clue how to write romance with anything but a big, broad stroke.
Just remember, an archaeologist knows not love. Wasn't that a Jedi knows not love? Wasn't that... So ridiculous.
Actually, he doesn't use a big broad stroke. He uses big swords in the shape of light versions and steel versions.
So, but I thought it was a fun roller coaster ride.
It was worth seeing. I agree.
You know, I think here's the deal, is that I didn't go expecting to see a masterpiece. You know, I went to see a roller coaster ride, and I think I got a roller coaster ride. One of the things I feel related to that movie is that, and this is a typical problem, I think, is that there's this magic that gets lost in the sequels because I can't. I was just either reading this or I was listening to NPR or something. But when he said it, it was like it really hit, which is that you lose the relationship part and you just get the action. So the sequels all have, you know, they all have the action that's connected to it, you know, that you remember. But you don't get the same relationship buildup or development that you would normally see in the original one because you already know that stuff. You know, but the problem is that without that deepening, you know, relationship part, I think it ends up just a little bit jerky.
Although I did think Spider-Man 2 was better than Spider-Man 1.
I thought X-Men 2 was really amazing.
See, there you go.
See?
So forget the whole thing.
And don't most boys like Godfather 2 better than Godfather 1? I'm not trying to disprove you. You are correct. I mean, I do think, yes, most sequels aren't as good. But the issue that I felt like
is there wasn't a lot of buildup. A lot of times, we weren't given time to be suspenseful with almost anything in the new Indiana Jones. That was the big issue that I had was that a lot of times things were just like, okay, now you're here. Now you're here. Now you're here. Now
right.
you're here. Like, there wasn't this
cut
buildup.
To, there's no plane ride. We're just somewhere else. Well, yeah. Like, there's no even concept of it's you're in one place and then cut to, like, jump cut to, you're totally in another place.
Even, like,
you know?
Temple of Doom. There's a huge, like, on their way there, there's them playing poker and they're doing the little thing, you know, or even in the first Temple of, you know, or in the first Indiana Jones where there's a getting to that gold idol at the beginning. There was a lot of setup and it was slow and it kind of built you up. But there was a whole bunch of character development that went on there that I felt like we didn't see very much.
Right.
And this is not really – this is the wrong show for this.
Yeah,
we drove there.
We had to say it. It's an event.
This weekend movie reviews.
$331 million over the weekend.
Well,
oh, 311. I'm sorry. 311.
They opened it on Thursday, though. I mean, they still did that sort of tricky, let's open it a day. No, I get it.
But still, it's not shabby.
They put those numbers in parentheses.
And more importantly, they got most of it.
Yeah, yeah.
This is an article in the Wall Street Journal called Studio's Latest Stunt, Less Risk and Less Reward. So the upshot of this is that a lot of these companies now are like Paramount, only got a very small percentage, I think 12.5% distribution fee. And more of these are happening. Marvel owns Iron Man. Different companies are now really these individual studios are really owning the thing because they have the money to do it. Now, the one thing I have to say about this, the Wall Street Journal is talking about how these studios, Paramount or others, are doing this to reduce risk. And I actually don't think that's the case. I think most of the examples that they gave us are companies who have the power to own it. So they're owning it. I don't think
the studios don't have a choice. So it's not a matter of the studio proactively deciding to reduce the risk. It's saying if we want any piece of this property, it's the only way to get it.
That's all they're giving up. And I think we saw that with Star Wars, that's what we saw. You know, with what George Lucas did was said basically, you know, I got the money, I can pay for this. So I'm gonna pay for it. And you get to do the little distribution and I'll pay you a couple cents.
So studios are in some cases just becoming distribution arms.
Right. They're becoming the distribution arm. They do some PR, they do some distribution. They don't have to put the money up, but they also don't get the reward. And I think this is in some cases the independent studio or the individual starting to take over.
Which sort of mirrors what we talk about a lot in the record business, doesn't it, with the Nine Inch Nails. I know we've done that example ad nauseum, so I'm not going to go there. But it's really not that different. We're seeing people, creators that have enough clout, like obviously George Lucas or Steven Spielberg or Trent Reznor or whoever it is, take back the control.
Right.
It'd be interesting to see when this shifts to TV.
Now the studios are trying to do lots of things. I mean, one is to do this distribution, try to figure this stuff out. They're also trying to add value to DVDs. Now, this is the first year, I think, or last year was the first year that we saw the DVD sales actually slump, right? And Blu-ray, we thought that once HD DVD went under, Blu-ray would explode.
And it really hasn't happened.
And it's kind of been a dud.
Well, it's kind of exploding, just not in the way they thought.
It was exploding out instead of up,
that's
right?
It's imploding. Implosions are bad.
Now, why aren't people buying Blu-rays?
Well, because of the extreme cost of the player to begin with.
Okay, it's an expensive player. What else?
Well, the cost of each piece of media is expensive as well.
They want us to pay $30 for a 44-cent piece of plastic.
Well, and then the other thing, and I think this is the critical aspect of it, is unless you have a television that's of sufficient size and clarity, most people can't tell the difference between a Blu-ray and a regular DVD.
Hooking up your Blu-ray player to a normal television gets you nothing. It's still – you might as well watch a DVD.
Even hooking it up to a, you know, a 32-inch flat screen, unless that flat screen really
– Well, and also is, the up-res has become so good that the up-resing technologies for DVDs, just regular DVDs going up, that's part of it. It's not just that you're looking at a Blu-ray being high def and a DVD being low def. The DVD is getting an up-res technology that is in many cases very, very well done. I've noticed that, like, the Vizio, and I don't know whether it's my Mac Mini or the Vizio that's doing the great work, but one of them makes the DVD zoom up look very, very good. Even QuickTimes. I mean,
That's your Mac. That's
the built-in – that's part of the QuickTime layer, which is taking advantage of the GPU to super enhance the pixels, to flatten those edges and to make sure that there's – and I think you don't see the – basically the bottom line is that you don't want to see the interlacing.
And I think that also the lower resolution, ironically, of my Vizio, the fact that it's a 720p
exactly.
Vizio, actually makes it look better on a larger screen. Because the Vizio that I got, I'm getting a new one, but right now I have a 37-inch or 36-inch Vizio that's hooked up to this Mac Mini. And I find that it looks just fine. Like, I don't feel like I need to have –
Actually, that thing lived in the office for a while, right?
It still lives in the office. It comes back to the office.
I see. Well, the reason why you got that was for the Apple TV. And that thing actually looks really cool.
Yeah, it looks great.
It's interesting to hear you, Alex, say that you don't necessarily need the highest quality. Because you and I have these conversations a lot when it comes to online video and the new Media Minute and other things where you notice the very fine gradations and quality that I don't always notice. That's not what my eye is trained to notice. But here you are in this situation saying that,
I'm resigned.
It's good enough, and I'm fine, and I don't need to have it in
the reason is I'm resigned. Because here's the worst part. I was at Scott's. I ruined Scott's entire viewing experience because Scott was showing me Comcast HD, and we're watching, and he goes, so what do you think? And he had this huge 60-inch, you know, crazy Scott machine. And I said, so the blocks in the sky don't bother you? And then that was it for him. But I was like, oh, this kind of looks like crap. I don't think it looks that much better than DVD, you know. And then I saw a Blu-ray, and I still see blocks. You know, some people see dead people. I see blocks. So the problem is, I saw a sky. I saw stuff. So I saw all these big blocks in a Blu-ray, and I was like, well, I'm not getting anything, because that's what drives me crazy. The softness doesn't drive me as crazy as the macro blocks that are showing up.
I see none of that.
Yeah, you just wait.
I don't
look at the sky. Don't look at the smoke. Don't look at the. You know, there's certain things not to look at, or you'll start seeing it, and then you'll see it everywhere.
Yeah.
And then you'll be walking down San Francisco. You know, you'll be walking down the street seeing little blocks.
So the thing that I noticed was last night when I saw the Raiders film, not Raiders, the Indiana Jones film, was that I didn't notice the stair stepping and the jittering that I notice when I watch a DLP theater movie. It just seemed more smoothed out. And I was complaining about that. Like, damn it, I can see the frames in the DLP. It was pissing me off. And Stu, of course, said, of course you can see the frames. Duh. Like, No, I'm seeing the errors.
And I haven't noticed that, but the now this what with these DVDs, though, to get back to this, what they're doing is they're this first one that they're working on is the from the graphic novel The Watchmen, and this is set for a March 2009 release. This is a big feature, but what they're doing is they're actually having a second. It's called The Tales of the Black Freighter, a second film. It's tentatively called Tales of the Black Freighter. That's going to be released only 5 days after the major release, and it's going to have this extra film on it. So they're going to have The Watchmen, these kind of like two movies together that are going to be released, and they're going to try to hopefully push, you know, more DVD sales.
And it's DVD only release.
It's DVD only.
The Tales of the Black Freighter is not going to be in theaters.
Yes.
That must mean they're not going to have much of the Black Freighter. Because in the comic it interleaves between the main story and this sub story within the comic.
Right. So it's going to be it's going to be connected, but not
part of it.
Exactly.
Do you know why I want to see The Watchmen?
Why?
My boyfriend's in it.
Your boyfriend's in it?
Yeah. Did you know Matthew Good is my boyfriend?
Who is
Matthew Good? The actor.
I had no idea.
British actor. He was in Match Point.
He's
my celebrity boyfriend.
He's your celebrity boyfriend.
I just wanted you all to know.
Thank you for sharing.
Okay. Anyway, but it's a great movie to do it for.
So and other people have done things like this. I mean, when we see something like The Animatrix, you know, The Animatrix was a great companion DVD on its own. I think that I also maybe. Is the idea of just adding features to the DVD not enough? Is that not enough to get people to buy? When you look at these DVDs that sell so well, you look at The Lord of the Rings, you look at Star Wars. I mean, part of it is that they're iconic movies. But I think that the other thing is it's four discs.
Okay, well, look at this. If you take the total sales of the number of people that bought the compilation Watchmen book, and they know what that number is, and we're going to call it 500,000.
Right.
So if that's the number that they can physically say, they go, if we can sell half of that market, we've sold another 250,000 units.
Right.
And that makes it worthwhile. But
I'm saying that this is a good idea, but I'm just wondering whether, you know, a lot of times what we get now, I mean, I look at the DVD, I walk over, you know, the Virgin Megastore is right across the street from us. And so I walk over there and I look at the DVDs, I look in the back and I look at whether they have any extras. And what I'm looking for specifically are visual effects extras, movie, you know, behind the scenes, you know, all these other things. If I don't see that, it's a Netflix. I mean, you know, I'm no longer interested right. in buying it. You know, right. I it used to be that when they first started doing DVDs, it seemed like everything had these extras in it. You know, everything had, you know, something that was there. Now most of the extras are crap. I mean, I don't count commentary as extras. I mean, I know someone out there is really upset I just said that, but I don't really like watching the commentary.
Do you think this is more significant? Does it portend sort of the end of the era? I mean, the Watchmen example is really interesting, and we'll see if that can inject life into it. But I wonder, I don't think this is necessarily what's at play, but I wonder if, I mean, I guess I would kind of like to hope that maybe there's this broader trend towards owning more digital copies. I mean, I know I don't buy CDs anymore
right.
for that
do,
same
do,
reason.
Do you buy DVDs?
Oh, I would buy a Matthew Good movie to. But no, seriously, I don't know. I don't buy DVDs. No, but I would rather own it. Yeah.
Okay, John,
but I would rather
Netflix?
Own a movie.
No, I don't do anything on any physical medium anymore. It's all digital.
And that's part of your Life
Netflix?
Zero approach.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So we've got most of us have Netflix. 3-1. Not that we're ganging up on John or anything. So,
no, I don't have anything against Netflix. It's just, you know.
So anyway, but the point is that whether it's digital download like John does or Netflix, the thing is that we don't if there's not anything special about the DVD that's any more than what we're getting through either the digital download or Netflix, the question it begs is why – you know, why bother? Why would I want to buy it?
Well, yeah, I would never buy a DVD. I would only buy a DVD if I liked the movie. I don't care about extras.
And I think that's part of the problem right now is that, you know, you ask. So first of all, the quote sales falling is 3.2%, and it's still a $15.9 billion industry. So, I mean, cry me a river, right? I mean, we're not exactly, it's not, you know, the end of the world as we know it in DVD.
Right.
You know, and so I think that's an important thing to keep in mind. But the other thing is, most people who have a collection of DVDs have a collection of, let's say, I think the average I read somewhere was 132 DVDs.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
132 DVDs. And those are, you know, when you think about people, there's this entire tribe mentality and everything. You can only really care about 100 and something things, right? There's a lot of research being done on that. You're talking about 132 DVDs that you have to replace if you move to a new medium. And that's, I guess that's just one of the things I was thinking about earlier when we were talking about this is if I had a choice between replacing 132 DVDs with Blu-ray, mm-hmm. where I could barely tell the difference unless I spent, you know, $5,000 on a TV, or I had the opportunity to simply rent or use Netflix or something like that,
right.
I would never, ever, ever, ever move to a new medium.
Well,
I think other people are saying the same thing.
Is physical done? I mean,
I hope so.
Well, we've talked about this at length, and as long as there's Walmart and Kmart and a distribution channel, there will always be a physical copy of something.
But I think the end of their reign in that space is near as well. I mean, iTunes is now the number one music retailer, period. Right?
Yeah, but it still only represents about 7% of the total number of music. The sheer volume of music is still only 7% is online.
Right. No, and I get that, but I'm saying they are the largest music
largest
retailer.
Largest single music
retailer, right. Mm-hmm. So you have an opportunity. I mean, it's funny to me whenever people tell me that, you know, quote, Windows is destroying the Mac in sales, because I think, well, you can't really say Windows versus Mac. You have to say Apple versus Dell versus Gateway versus Compaq versus IBM versus, right?
Well, you have to go out through this. I mean, it depends on how you argue it, Right. I mean, it could, because it is, if you're saying one operating system versus another, or whether you're saying a computer company versus another computer company.
Right.
Or
which, when we talk about these, when we talk about an online retailer or we talk about a music.
Right. We're talking about Dell versus Apple rather.
Yeah, we're talking about Dell versus Apple. Right. We're talking about one company versus another company.
And you're not really even talking about Dell versus Apple. You're talking about Dell versus HP because everyone's serving up the same thing, the same music.
Right.
Except for Nine Inch Nails' Pretty Hate Machine, which nobody's serving up.
Don't even get me started.
I have to walk over to Rasputin's and buy a used copy soon.
Why don't they? Why,
I lost
why
mine.
Isn't that on iTunes?
I don't know. Everything else by Nine Inch Nails is on there, and I can't find Nine Inch Nails' Pretty Hate Machine. If you're listening, Trent, we would really like you to put that on there. I'm sure it's some TBT crap.
Yeah, so that is the most infuriating thing for me as well.
Wasn't on Amazon, wasn't on there. I haven't checked.
I had somebody tell me the other day, somebody that I'm really close to, tell me that they, quote, hate Nine Inch Nails. And I said, oh, my God, you totally have to hear Pretty Hate Machine.
Yeah, Pretty Hate Machine is one of the top 10 albums ever made.
And then, of course, I can't find it. So.
Ever.
Ever.
Ever. YouTube. YouTube is starting Citizen News. They're taking over. They're going to blow ABC right out. Daisy, are you going to survive? Are you going to be able to survive the YouTube wash?
Yeah, and why aren't you on YouTube?
Well,
I'm sorry. What is happening?
So many questions here. This is Citizen News. So here's what's happening here. Here's the upshot. This is YouTube. You know, they have a lot of people. A couple people like to watch.
A few people like
to watch news. A few people like to watch YouTube, and some people are actually starting to watch the news. I find that if I'm looking for a clip, I go to YouTube first.
News is the second most popular category of online video, second only to YouTube in terms of. I mean, this is from a Forrester report in terms of the type of content that we specifically want to watch online. First is YouTube, and then second are news clips, both national and local news. And third are TV shows.
Do you watch a lot of news on the web?
I'm a little bit of a throwback. I prefer to read. I mean, I'd rather read a story, to be
that's
honest.
What I find. I have this choice. I have a choice on CNN all the time. Whenever I see a story and it has the little, you know, movie camera next to it, I'm like, oh crap! That means it's going to be a video, and I can't just scan the. I can't scan the article.
I'd rather just read.
This is as the person who always says video is going to take over the world, and I find myself wanting to. I just want the text because the text is like a little paragraph that just tells me that Obama got another three superdelegates. I don't need to watch a 4-minute video of that. I just need to know what the score is.
The hilarious thing is, so I did a little study of this and I said, okay, well, what's the difference between this and this? And generally when it's the video version, it is a paragraph that you could have read and been done and out with.
Well, the way news does it.
Yeah, I know. But I'm just saying that because that's the way news packages.
It's not dense enough.
Yeah, it's just there's not anything else to say.
It's not like Daisy stuff.
Well, no, but what I've gotten, that's some of the criticism that I've gotten for the New Media Minute, and it's from, you know, people that I know well. It's good, but I'd rather just read this in text. I don't necessarily need to read about online video movers. I don't necessarily need to watch online video movers and shakers. And yeah, it's sort of the way it goes. I mean, there are some things I prefer to watch, but yeah, generally with news, I'd rather read it. Now, the thing that about this sort of YouTube citizen journalism, which as I understand is they're sort of amassing folks that are already on YouTube and are just regular people that are reporting different types of news, kind of finding off the beaten path stories and pulling it together, aggregating it, so to speak, in sort of like a citizen journalism channel. Right. Now, a couple thoughts on this. I had an interesting conversation back in December with a good source of mine who works at an advertising agency. Mm. And obviously advertising has been roiled prior to news by changes on the internet. And advertisers have had to face issues like consumers creating ads for them. And what does that mean? And how do they adjust to it? And they've been forced or are being forced to adjust how they create ads based on sort of user-generated media. And now I think as journalists, we're starting to feel this now a little bit after advertisers are. And what he said to me is, well, what happens when people just get their news from other people, what does that do to journalists? And of course, we like to think, oh, well, our stories are vetted and it's a credible name. It is a concern. It is definitely a concern. And it's a concern specifically for that reason. And I want to bring up an example. When I was at South by Southwest, we were listening, my husband and I were driving into the show and we were listening to a radio show where they were sort of debating like a blog, a sports blog versus ESPN. Now, here's the issue. When I reported on Quarter Life's demise, I filed the story to my editor and I misquoted it. He caught it while we were editing it, but I misquoted it. I said it was the worst ratings that NBC had had in 20 years. I took that from a Reuters story. Mm-hmm. And
you took it from a Reuters story. We'd like to underline, took it from a Reuters story.
I'm showing you guys how the sausage gets made. Okay, this is not like my best, being honest here. I should have done a better job as a reporter. But he said to me, he goes, this was actually the worst ratings in 17 years. And I said, oh, I'm damn, I got that from a Reuters story. Right. You have to vet this all yourself. If we had printed that, NBC would have been all over us on Monday morning. That is the difference. When I make a mistake, any mistake in a story, they all contact me. The PR people contact me. The executives contact me. And they expect us at Television Week and other publications to hold to a higher standard. When you're writing for a blog and it's your own personal blog, they're not getting calls from whoever it is at NBC saying, fix this story. That's the difference, is the things that are going out there aren't always
on
correct.
The other side
and
of that,
we have to hold a higher standard.
On the other side of that, though, I have a personal anecdote that's the other side of that process, which is that in 2000, during the big elections in Zimbabwe, I was there. You know, I was in Harare, Zimbabwe during the big elections, and I watched CNN do this, you know, whatever they did, and it had nothing to do with reality. It had nothing to do with what we were looking there. And the thing is that in the early days of DV Garage and the Pixel Corps, you know, in all the little business plans, it was always like, in one of these days, you know, if we're successful and we arm lots of people and we give lots of people what they need, you know, they'll have another election in Zimbabwe and CNN will send down two guys from Atlanta. And you know, and then we'll have 40 people who can speak Shona. And the difference is what happens when you get more accurate data from the people on the ground. I mean, that's the issue. Is that while the press may vet, and you know, it's not necessarily going to be accurate because it's going through this huge filter of I'm a reporter and I'm looking for a story that's going to end up on the nightly news, and if it's not exciting enough, I'm not going to post it. You know,
you're right. Of course, yes, we want sexy stories. We want big names and stories. Mm-hmm. We want to quote Michael Eisner. Absolutely. There's some truth to that. And I think your example is a very good one. And I think certainly for things like that that are much more political in their nature and much more sort of like emotional, what's actually happening on the streets. But for the type of stuff that I cover that is not so much, I don't have to be out watching a political rally or anything that's based on numbers. I think that's the thing. Somebody else's blog can go report on a TV show and its ratings or whatever it is and report the investment dollars in Revision 3 incorrectly. And Jim Lauterbach isn't going to call them up and correct them.
I'm not quite sure I agree with that. I mean, I've had a couple of opportunities in the past where I've written something on my blog that I absolutely knew for a fact was true. I was in a room when it happened. I heard the person say it. They told me they could be quoted, and then someone in that organization sent me a cease and desist or we're coming after you. I've had that happen, and I'm just a lowly little blog writer, for TV Week.
And the other thing is that almost every article that I've ever seen written about something that I actually know about, you know, something that I've been there, whether it's Zimbabwe or computer graphics or farming or, you know, whatever it is that I happen to actually have some sense of reality with. Every time I see that article, I think to myself, I read it by some journalist and I go, this person's full of crap.
Okay, let me ask you a question.
Okay, no, wait. But I go, this person is full of crap. That's not at all the way it is. You know, we never do it that way, or it never happens that way, or very rarely. It's picking up this little piece of something and extrapolating into it, and it's not accurate at all. The only time I think that they're actually telling the truth is when they're telling me about things that I don't know anything about. And then I go, it must be the truth because I don't, you know, that must be accurate, you know. But anytime they're talking about anything that I know anything about, I'm like, they have no idea what they're talking about.
So, okay, you know a lot about what I cover. Do you feel that way about my stories? Moment of truth. I want to know what you really think. Do you feel that I'm accurately representing what's happening in the media business?
Ironically enough, I find that your stuff is pretty accurate. But you're also...
I have you on this show because we think you're full of...
Yeah. No, we finally got you right where we want you. Now we are going to take you down.
See, that is true citizen journalism, Alex.
No.
Defend yourself and your stories that I don't agree with.
But the thing is that you write about things that I don't really know what those numbers are. I don't know, you know, when you say that there's all these things or there's you know, lots of investment or whatever it is, that sounds great. You know, to me, you know, that, and so it is, it's, if now, if you started talking about compression techniques or green screen or whatever, you know, then, you know, I might want to argue with you, you know, so
stay tuned for that report.
Yeah, exactly.
But anyway, I think that there's something interesting. I think that, you know, citizen news, there's a lot of problems with it. I think it'll be inaccurate, horribly inaccurate a lot of times and horribly biased. But I think that there is this.
Yeah, but how is that any different from the modern press?
Well, that's part of my point. So the, you know, is that there's.
We really try. I really do believe that. Yeah. I'm sorry. I hate to be an optimist but I really believe that a lot of journalists try to hold to a standard.
I'm not saying that they're not trying. I'm just saying they're not hitting very often.
There's a difference between being a journalist for a specific industry, a tech industry or a movie industry or whatever, because those are hard fact numbers and you can go and get those people. The part – I guess the point when I was making about – well, how is that any different than modern journalism? Look at the spin that's happening on the election right now. You watch one show, it's biased this way. Right. You watch another show, it's biased this way. And the way that the journalists are calling them – are basically putting themselves above citizens when they say, oh, the people or the citizens or the whoever. And it's almost like they're talking down to them.
Well, they are talking down.
I understand that.
Now, the thing is also when we talk about news, it may not be punditry that we're talking about here. Citizen news can also be something happens in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Cat stuck in tree.
Right.
Or a hurricane or a tornado, and suddenly you have 15 views of what this thing looked like as it went through. You know, that's the – or you have – police brutality, or you have, you know, all kinds of other things that are going on. That's also citizen news. And I think that the attack of the little brother, you know, we're always worried about big brother, but big brother has more to worry about from little brother everyone with a camera. I mean, because we're looking at a point where, you know, 2 or 3 years from now, you won't be able to buy a phone without a camera.
I think that ultimately citizen journalism is a good thing, and I think we're all going to figure out ways to mix this. I mean, I don't expect that people are just going to read my stories or stories on abcnews.com, and I think that smart journalists have to be aware of that, and I can't just sit here and say, well, Alex, my stories are vetted, so therefore you should trust them. That's the point. I mean, I've discussed this with my friends who are journalists, and we all agree that, you know what, yes, we believe that we have the sources and that we vet our stories and that we can do a good job, but that we still have to really protect ourselves and make sure we're future-proofed by acknowledging citizen journalism, by bringing them in somehow to the stories that you're covering.
The thing that I have to say is that this conversation sounds very familiar to what I heard. Okay, in the early 90s, there was this thing called Photoshop, and it came out, and suddenly people with no experience whatsoever could do pre-press work. You know, they could actually create brochures, and they could create magazine articles and magazine and whole magazines and all this other stuff. And they used this thing called Photoshop and Illustrator and PageMaker. And the big complaint was from all the ad agencies and all the pre-press houses and all the other stuff, well, now anybody can do it. It's all going to be crap. You know.
That's what's happening.
But here's what happened, though, is that it went crazy. And there was an enormous amount of stuff that you could barely read. I made ads that you couldn't actually read. There was all kinds of – but I was getting paid $7 an hour, you know, to make ads that you can't read.
Exactly.
But then what happened was that then it kind of sorted itself out into something that was much more dynamic. You know, from a design point of view, our, what we see today on in the magazine rack is much more dynamic than what we saw in the 80s, partially because there was a whole new, you know, group of people who got to be included that didn't go through all of the – you know, the art schools and weren't driven into this is the way it has to be and so on and so forth. That's all I have to say about that.
I think
for citizen journalism to work, the citizens still have to follow journalistic practices. They still have to be aware of what laws support them, what they can say.
I think the ones that succeed, the ones that grow, the blogs that grow are ones that we think that we can trust. You know, people, you know, and a lot of them run a lot hot and heavier. You know, if you look at the Daily Kos or Huffington Post or whatever, they're a lot more out there than what we see on CNN or ABC. But a lot of times you're seeing the news there 3 days before you see the news on the big ones. You know, because it goes through the vetting. But if you want to see all of it, you know, and that's what I think. I don't think it's going to be either or. I think we're going to watch citizen news and then we're going to wait for it to filter up to figure out what actually, you know, like.
Well, that's what my husband says about National Enquirer and Star. They're pretty much always right, but you don't believe it until it shows up in People or
until you see you see an alien pig coming out of a Hungarian woman.
Exactly.
Until
you see that on headline news, you don't believe it.
You know, one of the things that citizen news has right now is Dig and Reddit and those things where the collective is filtering the important stories to the top, or what we think are the important stories.
Now, there's more discussion on giving it away. Give it away and pray isn't a business model. This is from TechDirt. But it doesn't mean that free doesn't work. So a lot of this was a reaction. We've talked about this a little bit, but did you guys get to see this article? Were you able to dig through it?
I did, and I was looking at this from the point of view of when the book comes out that says give your stuff away, people are like, okay, we'll give it away. But then they don't have the – they haven't thought about the back end.
Right.
They haven't thought about what the goal of giving something away for free is.
Right.
So I'll give you an example. Last week I went to see Cory Doctorow at his book signing party for Little Brother. Mm-hmm. Okay. So here's a guy who's going to give away this book in a zillion formats, in text and PDF and HTML and any other format that it can get made into. There's going to be a audiobook version of it that will be given away. But the thing, flip side
of
that,
people are still there buying it.
People are still buying it. They're lining up to get it signed because they're going to give it to somebody who's not going to read it online or doesn't have the ability to read it in another form. And so in his case, his thing has always been, I don't want to be obscure. I want to be a known author. So giving books away mm-hmm. actually propelled him into having, you know, bigger and better books every single time. Up until this last release, all of his books were paperback. So the new book is a hardback book.
Well, and this is what we did.
We did this 7 years ago. The idea with DV Garage when it got launched was to say, we're going to give away content that will help you see better, that will help you with your Photoshop better, will propel you as an artist in order to understand these tools. But buy our DVD.
A lot of people did.
And you know the thing with
that's why you still have a job seven years later because you had a business strategy.
And then 3 years later, we almost ran out of money. So from that first little push, I had been on Tech TV giving away free tips on Photoshop for a year, and then we said, oh, by the way, I have a DVD, and once again,
had one fatal flaw, Alex.
Yes.
You gave away a really cool texture that was really useful, so there was no reason to buy the other textures.
You know, the other textures are actually very good.
I know, but I'm just saying that if you had that one texture.
That one texture.
No, if you spun it around and used different parts of it, zoomed in and out, that's all you needed was that one texture.
I like the other texture.
Now, investors are starting to target web video, and this is an article written by – wait a minute. It's written by Daisy Whitney.
So, therefore, it wasn't vetted.
Right. We should fact check it.
Everything.
What's the story?
There's a lot of numbers in here, Alex. I don't know if I trust them.
I decided, I'm not going to read this one. I'm just going to
have me summarize.
Daisy summarize.
What we really wanted to do was take a look at, worked pretty closely with my editor, Greg Bauman, on this one. And he really wanted to address the idea of how is this current influx of money? Like, we know that there is a lot of money flowing into web video and some of its content and some of its services and software. But nevertheless, it was $461 million last year.
Some of that's flowing right into my pocket.
And I think that's great. And $217 million in the first three quarters of this year alone. So what he wanted to do was really challenge these investors to explain why this is different from previous times that investors have invested in Hollywood. You know, the Germans have invested in Hollywood, the Japanese have invested in Hollywood. And generally speaking, betting on content is risky. I mean, that's kind of, it segues back to what we talked about with Paramount and Indiana Jones. I mean, Hollywood is a business that is built on the idea of big hits. And of course, you have to have a lot of flops before you can get there. So mm-hmm. we really wanted to look at what has changed? Have the fundamentals changed with investing so that venture capitalists are willing to put so much money into content this time? And, you know, I think that their answers were pretty good. I mean, it's all of the things that, I mean, you guys are all drinking the same Kool-Aid as me, but it was the whole idea that with web video, we're not betting on hits. We're betting on targeted niche content. You can ultimately start to have higher CPMs with this content, and that at least a lot of the early content that's come out so far on the web has been proven to have an audience base. It's the Revision right. 3 shows. It's you know, the shows that appeal. It's the Pixel Core type of shows, the MacBreak mm-hmm. Weeklies, the This Week in Tech, and so on and so forth, that are proven to have an audience amongst the early adopters. But I think that it goes back to that whole idea of, you know, there's wisdom in crowds and small is the new big, and that with web video, you no longer have to bet on hits. And it's also the other thing that investors said is it's very similar to investing in cable 25 years ago. We didn't know all of these channels would be hits, but they are.
More than anything else, when I look at podcasting, what it reminds me the most of is that first 3 weeks of MTV, or the first year of MTV. You know, it's these little networks that looked so crunchy. Or you look at the documentaries that were done in the early 90s by Discovery Networks, by History Channel, and They were butt ugly. I mean, there was a lot of really ugly, ugly stuff going on in the early 90s. But they didn't have – I mean, the budgets were $50,000 per, you know, per piece, or you know, the Discovery networks. The big Discovery was $75,000, and then the little Discovery ones were like $25,000 or $30,000. And it was just – there wasn't a lot of money in it. And they have grown to being, you know, a huge –
Planet Earth.
A huge entity, yeah. I mean, and so I think that, and I this does feel like it's going this direction, you know. And I don't. Do you guys think the niche is enough?
Oh, obviously, I think that the niche is so important that that's the only place that you should target.
Yeah.
Like, why would you go try to make a hit? Because then the hit means more infrastructure, more bandwidth, more in control, more people to support it. Having a team of – you know, I have to pay more people for a hit. I don't have to pay a lot of people for, you know, being a minor web celebrity. And I'm not – I'm – okay. When I say me being – I'm using that as the air quotes, not
No, I totally agree with it. I think that, and we talked about this on the show last week, I think that a segmented market approach is exactly the way that this should be done. And I think that there's huge yield in that. And I think that we talked about advertisers finding that as a new medium. I mean, certainly content providers are starting to see that as well.
As we start to see results, I think the other thing is we'll start to be able to command higher CPMs, which is really what's going to make this work. I mean, you have to have, for a little 3 to 5 minute video show in a niche, you got to figure out a way, in my opinion, to make about $3,000 to $5,000 an episode. You know, that's the, you know, the...
What sort of CPMs? What does that translate to into a CPM, Alex?
Well, if you're getting, let's say you can get to 100,000, you know, viewers, then you're looking at a $35 to $50 CPM for 100,000 users. Now, that's what I would consider a minimum. You know, what you want to do is try to get, I think that you can get to a $70, $80 CPM. And then if you have that across a... 100,000 viewers. I think then you're looking at $7,000-$8,000 per show, and then you keep the shows to being something that you can build for 2,000-4,000. And that's a big model that we've spent a lot of time on is figuring out how do we squeeze into those numbers. And it means that you don't do. You know, I was at another production last week, and there was a lot of people there. I was like, you know, for something that we would have two people, you know, they had like 10, and you know, they probably didn't make the same mistakes.
Did they have bagels?
Yeah, they didn't have any bagels, but they had soft drinks.
They had okay, but did they have no? The thing is, if the production's that big, do they have the food?
They didn't in this case. They didn't have the food, but they had a makeup artist, and they had a person that was managing captures, and they had another sound recordist, and they had someone managing the teleprompter, and then they had a director, and then they had a producer, and then they had another producer, and then they had somebody else that was standing there, and then they had, you know, it was like one of those things that there was a whole bunch of people there, and I was like, wow, this is.
See, if they could just memorize. I could get rid of that teleprompter.
Ooh, she's showing up. Just for those of you who watch the New Media Minute, you got to understand, she memorizes that. She may look like she's doing it off a teleprompter, but she memorizes it.
She's just proven that she's a professional.
You see that I built that Jankalicious teleprompter.
I would like
out there.
To try it though. Yeah, it would be interesting to see. I wonder. I feel like I'll sound more canned if I suddenly switch to a teleprompter. That I wonder. $32. Yeah. How much was it, Alex?
$32.
Okay.
Piece of glass, some black fabric, and a broken LCD screen.
Yes, that was it. That was pretty much it. It was very inexpensive. So the also here, Howcast, this is also a Daisy Whitney special, has added distribution partners. So they're going to AOL, Metacafe, Bebo, and Blip.
Well, I think we had chatted about How-To Videos in the past, but they're really among
Howcast is the one the furthest along. I mean, it looks like they looked at what everyone else was doing, and then they did it better.
Well, they have, I think their founders are Google and YouTube people, and generally Google hires smart people. So yeah. I wouldn't be surprised if they're one of the winners. I mean, how-to videos are among the most popular, how-to in general is among the most popular of search queries,
when we talk about
and
niche,
certainly for videos.
When we talk about niche, I mean, I think this is one of the massive niches, is all these little things that are, you know, when I'm not going to make anyone take any drinks here, but, you know, when you want to look at magazines, there's a lot of niches there. And the main thing is that's what people I think are going to be really interested in. And the key is making it actually useful. I mean, the problem with Howcast is that I get my little, you know, I'm subscribed to Howcast on iTunes or whatever, and I get them, and it gets back into, I watch half of them going, oh, that's really not the way to do that. So, you know, so the Howcast is not
You're going to get blowed up if you follow those directions.
Yeah, well, mostly like don't ever iron your shirt that way. So just in case you're wondering, if you look at the ironing shirt one on Howcast, don't do it.
Iron do chef. It that way.
It's bad.
But fold your shirt the way that they suggest. It's really awesome. It yeah, it's this really quick, put the hand in and flip it over. It's really awesome.
You were very excited about
that? That's how my t-shirts get folded when I fold them. I have figured it out. I have a lot of
see your t-shirt drawers, John Flowers.
You know what's really funny about that? Just a quick little side note. So you talk about segmented markets and these markets. There's this site called Becky's Homestead, and it's basically how to go from a consumer lifestyle into a self-sufficient, community-driven, eco-friendly homesteading lifestyle. And so she was really excited about Life Zero. Mm-hmm. And so I did a little video for her to kind of show her the Life Zero apartment that I have. And there's actually like a shot of my closet with all of my clothes, with the folded t-shirts. And I'm explaining this is how they're folded and all this. So it's pretty, yeah, it's pretty off the rails.
And that's at Becky's Homestead?
Yeah, I don't think it's up yet. But.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so, yeah, it's... scary.
So, but we talk about segmented markets. I mean, that is an example where someone has carved out a really great opportunity to talk about this sort of homesteading lifestyle. And, you know, it's funny that the things that make the most sort of money, or the things that have the most users anyway, are things like knitting and yarn clubs and all of these really segmented markets that you wouldn't expect. Well, we wouldn't expect because we're largely technology people.
It's okay. I don't knit anymore, Tom. It's all right.
But they're huge. I mean, they're just enormous markets.
Well, I mean, you look at something like, I mean, this is a niche. I mean, Photoshop, you know, and Photoshop is
it's smaller than the knitting niche, though.
It is. Photoshop is much smaller. But all I got to say is that it was like this when I did my first training disc for Photoshop. You know, I was getting three or four requests a day to do a training disc. And I was like, you know, you go to Borders and there's like an entire section connected to Photoshop. Why do you want me to make a disc? And, oh, we want you to make a disc.
Because you worked on Star Wars. That's why.
Anyway, so I did the disc. I did the disc. And it was just like you just poked into this little thing. And just lots of water came out. You know, it was like, how is this possible? Like, how does anyone, you know, and I'm surprised I haven't done more. In fact, I'm doing another set of Photoshop discs. I'm working on this summer. It's the 10 things you need to know about Photoshop.
Cool.
I'm working on
Command
it.
H. Yes. Yeah. Command A.
It's all about Command H. Yeah, I'm just going to list them. It'll be like 3 minutes it'll long. It'll be like it'll be only $10. So now, segmenting markets. AFTRA is still talking, even though SAG is not. What is going on over here?
Well, David.
So they broke up.
David sent us that little explainer last night.
We should just insert the video of him saying that right
now.
Yeah,
David. What we should do is, you know what we're going to do is we're going to shelve this one because it'll probably be more interesting.
We should have him on here.
Well, I think we can give a summary. I think we can give
a summary. The bottom line is that they've broken up and they're trying to, AFTRA and SAG are negotiating separately. Right. AFTRA is having trouble, which means SAG will have a lot more trouble because AFTRA is probably a little bit easier to work with than SAG is. But it really creates this confusion of what happens if AFTRA signs one and SAG doesn't when they have a crossover of like 40 or 50% of their members.
And I think his feeling was be prepared for another strike.
Right.
He doesn't think there'll be sort of an immediate happy ending.
My question is that if I'm an actor and I think that SAG is going down the wrong direction and AFTRA has signed and I'm already part of AFTRA or I'm not part of AFTRA, why don't I become AFTRA? You know, why don't I become an AFTRA?
Right, why not move to AFTRA?
And just say, you know, that's I vote with my feet because this is the deal. You know, I want to get a deal. Now, a lot of this is over. A lot of the push back and forth is over these short form pieces. So the less than 6 minute
the promo clips.
Well, they call them promo clips, but we have to remember when we promo clips being 6 minutes long. That's the David had a good point that's like the length of all the Saturday Night Live clips.
True.
You know, so
right, or segments on the Daily Show or
all of those things.
I mean, there's all kinds of things that are under 6 minutes.
Or sometimes segments on 60 Minutes or you know, right, segments on Dateline NBC. You know, all of those things can be, you know, that length. That's a length that gets very close to the average segment length for a lot of shows. And so that isn't, you know, it does include a lot. And so that's a lot of what the pushing and pulling is going over. But we're going to have to find a time where we can bring David on because he's the one that can really explain it to us.
And I think I should actually put forth one clarification that David pointed out and actually several people pointed out to me directly. I don't know about you, Alex, but
no,
there's this sort of idea out there that we all hate Hollywood.
Yeah, we don't hate Hollywood.
And I think that that's a mischaracterization. I think that, you know, what I personally, I can speak for myself, but not you. I mean, I love what Hollywood produces. I hate some of the bureaucracy that gets created in Hollywood. And so that's what I'm railing against, is the red tape and bureaucracy, not the fact that they're producing movies, because I think a lot of Hollywood movies are pretty good.
I think that I find Hollywood more amusing than it doesn't really well up hatred. Right. It's mostly like watching little kid grab onto a boiling hot water, you know, a pot of boiling hot water over and over and over again, going, you know, eventually he's going to realize that he's going to keep on burning his hands that way. That's more when I look at Hollywood, that's more just like, you know, they keep on doing the same thing, expecting a different outcome. You know, that's the definition of insanity. So now to jump onto the tech end, we've got a couple tech stories before we sign out here. Have you guys seen this Adobe Acrobat Connect Pro?
It reminds me of something else that Adobe already makes, but I couldn't remember the name of it.
Yeah, but
it's like rebadged Adobe or Macromedia.
Yeah, I think it's a lot
Flash
more
Flash something or other. No, yeah. No, it's all this tech. I mean, I've seen this technology before. It's been sitting in the wings for a long time. I think it's, like I said, I think it's just rebadged, but I couldn't remember the name of the product.
I think it's heavily improved. I mean, I think that we're finally starting to see the interconnection between Adobe and Macromedia actually coming to fruition. Yeah. I think before it was like kind of Frankenstein company mixture, sure. You know, mostly.
Well, the thing with this is going to be if it's very expensive, like the other iteration of this was, mm-hmm. then no one's going to use it. I mean, this has to be able to land on in a corporate server or servers, or land on my ISP or wherever I can install this so that I can use it. Because before, it was in the neighborhood of $40,000 for something pretty basic.
I'm trying to understand how this the Acrobat Connect, the Adobe Acrobat Connect Pro thing is just basically video conferencing over the web.
It's screen sharing. So yeah. It's basically the conference thing. I mean, a lot of people have this problem. They have to have one speaker talk to many people within a group.
Right.
It has to be recorded. It has to be editable.
Right.
It has to be screen. You have to have chat back so you can ask questions, because the bandwidth coming back on the other side isn't going to work.
Right.
You have to, you know, there's a whole lot of problems to solve with this, and it's a huge problem, and it's not an easy task to solve. But the bottom line is that no one will use it if it's too expensive.
When the price is you know, if you're using there are subscription models, and so it's $375 a month for 5 users, starter pack for $750 a month for a 10 user. Now I don't know if the users are the people who are broadcasting.
Those are the people that are watching.
All right.
For 10.
Yeah, I'd like to understand how this is different than WebEx or
but it's using the Flash interface. It's using the, you know, the thing is it's the same as WebEx or, you know, those kind of things, GoToMeeting.
Right.
But the advantage that Adobe is at least purporting is, that it's going to, that what you're going to end up with is something that is, you're able to use the other development platforms. And so if you're building stuff in Flash, if you're building stuff, you'll be able to access it all,
yeah.
Which does have certain advantages. You know, you have a lot of people who know how to use Flash. You have a lot of people that know how to use a lot of those other things. And being able to incorporate those in to this, you know, could be interesting as far as that goes. But yeah, I have to, if the
you
subscription,
have to really, it's,
the,
it's
a, the subscription is really per user.
Yeah, it really is.
Oh,
it's a pretty big gulp.
So if I look at this, I watched the little video. If I watch the video for this Adobe Acrobat Connect Pro overpriced WebEx-like thing, mm-hmm. and then I go and I'll watch the video for OS X Leopard iChat screen sharing and application sharing.
Yeah, but that's user to user. That's user to user.
It is user to user, except you can have, you know, like up to three users,
right.
As well. Yeah.
Right. Well, and
for free.
Well, I think this is where, you know,
I'm just saying they look very similar.
I think this is where Apple's going to keep on doing what it's doing, which is that Apple is going to keep on adding more of these features and not charging for it.
So
it might be $99 a year for your Mac account to be able to do it. And I think that's going to be the issue. I think that now for a large company paying, you know, $75, if you're doing lots of training, paying $75 per person per month.
That's cheap.
It's not that expensive to be able to distribute all of this stuff. So it's not that bad for us as a little company.
Right.
We're kind of like, well.
The problem they're solving is they're pushing the content up to a centralized location and then distributing it out there. rather than doing kind of a peer-to-peer solution. So the host doesn't have to have a ridiculous amount of bandwidth.
It's a one-to-one.
Normal bandwidth.
It's a one-to-one and then a server-to-many.
Right.
And if you can imagine, like if you're a school, being able to manage e-learning like courses and curriculum, you know, if you just add that, if you know that you're going to have someone on for a three-month course and you just make it $225 more,
right,
and then everybody has access to it, you know, it's a way to proctor the courses in a way that makes sense.
I think that e-learning is a different price model.
Right. Yeah, so it'll be – anyway, the other two technologies, and we're running out of time here, is the – one is the Spectra Visual Newsreader. What did you think of this? John, you looked at it.
I spent about an hour with this yesterday.
Yeah, I spent about 20 minutes. Yeah.
It's pretty addictive.
It's addictive. I felt like
I don't think I want to read my news this way. I think I'm going to get bored of it after a little while longer.
So Spectra is on msnbc.msn.com, and if you we'll have a link in the show notes. But the you can find areas of tech and travel and you know all these other things. You can add them, and then it creates like this little spirally thing that you could. It's like little stories floating around in the sky.
If you want to see it, onto them. If you want to see it, you can go to. Your Mac screensaver and turn on the RSS news thing. It looks kind of like that.
What's interesting about it is more that we're just starting to see more people really adding that kind of 3D element, trying to play with a new interface. I don't think this is the interface. I don't think they quite get it here. But they're playing with something that's kind of getting them down the road.
The argument will be for me is that, you know, eventually I'm going to just say, can I have the text? I'm going to go back to an RSS a text RSS experience rather than looking at this 3D thing.
Right.
Unless there's something else that's here that comes up with this, like the pictures or the pre-streaming of the story, for example. So there's no reason for me to click and wait for the stuff. It should just – all those stories, all that stuff should be there in the background so that when I go to look at it, it's all formatted nice and looks awesome.
Right.
The fact that this takes over the screen and also looks a little bit like a game means that I'm going to get some crap from the kids when they think that I should be working.
Right. It looks a lot like – by the way, it looks – the rendering looks a lot like Anarch's 3D renderer. For some reason, it just reminds me of that.
Oh, yeah.
You know what it looks like to me? It looks like Jonathan Harris Universe.
Oh, yeah.
It looks exactly like it. It looks like they just totally freaking ripped it off.
Maybe they hired him.
Yeah. So, Jonathan, if you're out there – we've met a few times. You should shoot me an email and let me know if they blatantly ripped you off or if you're working with them.
Finally, MP3 revolutionizes the way you listen to music. New MP3 revolutionizes. Does this look like it's going to be anything?
I think it'll be fun.
It's called MT9 technology. And this is – it allows you to have – is it up to six tracks?
Six tracks.
So you can add – this allows you to have an MP3 that you could turn, for instance, the voice track off so that you could buy your Nine Inch Nails Pretty Hate Machine and you could turn
it's
off –
it's in karaoke along
so,
with
so you
it.
Got – yeah, if you want to do karaoke, you know, when you could turn on Head Like a Hole, turn off Trent's voice and try to screech like him.
When I think karaoke, I kind of think Bon Jovi.
Living on a Prayer, right? I know you. That's how it is.
That is the best song to sing karaoke. We used to make up Living on a Prayer.
We used to make up all kinds of stuff for.
Make it, I swear.
Oh gosh. yeah. We
keep going. That is I'm not gonna sing that.
More than I ever need to hear, John. Thanks.
We have so many different lyrics for Bon Jovi songs, and I can't say any of them on this show. So it was a very good one to make really rough when you were working on the farm.
You know, the only one that the best rewrite of words is the Go-Go's Our Lips Are Sealed, which is Our Pets Are Seals.
Okay. So, but
no, this is cool because.
Is it going to go anywhere? I mean, it is.
I would use this because I did a production of 3 weeks ago or so, and we kept running into issues with lyrics on songs. And they wanted something popular. They wanted something recognizable, but they didn't want the person singing it.
Right.
Like, okay, I can take some voice out to a point. I can use the pre-verb. I can take the cables and weird wire them, and I can do what I can to get rid of that voice. But it sure would have been nice to just go –
you know, by the way, just in case you need that, I have a box that does that.
You
for
do?
Me. Yeah, I have a box.
Okay.
I used to be a DJ a long time ago, and I had a karaoke box, and I still have it. And it just takes – you put the regular CD in. What it does is it inverts the the stereo channel.
Like I said, it weird wires it.
It weird wires the stereo channel and then cancels the anything that's in the center, which oftentimes is the voice.
Uh-huh.
And, so you can build a little box that does that. In fact, we're going to do a GMT actually on how to weird
make
wire.
One. Yeah.
Anyway, so
there was a really great software tool, and we'll post the link in the show notes. but it got rid of the vocals to an acceptable level.
So anyway, this is one of those new things. We'll see. It looks like Samsung and LG are both interested in equipping their phones with it, and so we might see something. I mean, I don't know how interested people are going to be in turning this all on and off.
But. There was a little production company that I worked with that was doing things with remixing MP3s. Mm-hmm. So you could change the channel. Right. So you could make it sounding like spinning or over here on the left or the right. I don't know. They got a couple of million bucks to do
and
it.
Having the different tracks allows you to do it. It would allow a phone or an MP3 player to dynamically change the feel of the song as far as stereo or surround sound. That could be in different tracks to let you kind of move it around.
So it would be cool if we had the spatial slider here so I could, mm-hmm. Click this track. Pull this out over here so the drums could look like, or sound like different. Or even I've always wanted to hear Green Day songs without the drum track.
Yeah. John, where can people find you?
MacBreakTech.com is where the newest episode of learning about tech things on your Mac.
What was the most recent episode?
We did a thing – well, last week we did a thing called Saving Your Project, which talks about file name conventions and
– Excellent.
And folder saving. And the newest one is on Preview.
Nice. John.
Hi. You can find me at lifezero.org, where I have a collection of writings, but I also have a new podcast that just came out last week. It has Ben Durbin on it, and Excellent. Response has been really positive so far. So.
Awesome.
And I just also wanted to say thanks to the people who've donated to Life Zero. I was shocked, and I do appreciate it.
So that you can buy less stuff.
Well, I guess they're donating to the lifestyle that allows me to podcast about my lifestyle.
I'm Daisy. You can read my stories on tvweek.com every day, and you can watch the New Media Minute at daisywhitney.com.
And this mess that you've been listening to. Oh, wait, one more thing. Just to make sure people know, we're doing a bunch of training here in the PixScore. Both green screen, podcasting, and visual effects. That's coming up in June. If you want more information about that, you can check it out at pixscore.com. And this mess that you've been listening to is This Week in Media. We are over and out.